Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Welcome. Welcome to The Deep Dive.
Great to be here.
Today we're taking a deep plunge into a figure who, well, often seems to vanish into the historical background, doesn't he?
He really does.
Yet his indelible mark on American politics is absolutely undeniable. Martin Van Buren.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission for this deep dive is to pull back the curtain on the surprising facts, the shrewd strategies, and the lasting contributions of the 8th U.S. president. He's a man whose story is far more intricate and honestly captivating than you might initially believe.
I think so, too.
We're going to uncover why this little magician deserves far more of our attention.
And what's truly fascinating here, I think, is this paradox you mentioned. How could someone so profoundly influential in shaping America's political system, I mean, a primary founder of the Democratic Party, also be widely considered forgettable?
Right. Time magazine even put him on a list of top 10 forgettable presidents.
Right. Exactly. It's baffling. But as we navigate his journey today, you'll see why his story is, well, anything but forgettable. He was a master political organizer, a really canny diplomat, and a figure whose own convictions evolved quite dramatically, actually, over his career.
Okay.
We're going to unpack the layers that make him a truly singular character in American history. Hashtag #4tag I, the unexpected roots of old Kinderhook.
Okay, let's unpack this right from the start with a genuinely surprising fact about Martin Van Buren.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this one usually gets people.
Go on.
Out of all the U.S. presidents, he holds this unique distinction. He's the only one who spoke English as a second language.
That's the one. Still amazing to think about.
Imagine that. Born Martin Van Buren, that's M-A-A-R-T-E-N, in 1782 in the quiet Dutch-speaking community of Kinderhook, New York.
Right up the Hudson River.
Exactly. He grew up in an environment just steeped in Dutch culture and language. His name, pronounced Van Jaren, and his family's ancestry was entirely Dutch, tracing back to the earliest European settlers in that region.
Real Knickerbocker roots.
Totally. His father, Abraham Van Buren, was more than just a patriot during the American Revolution. He was a key local figure, joined the Democratic Republican Party later on, and he owned an inn and tavern right there in Kinderhook.
Which was crucial.
Absolutely crucial. It wasn't just their home. It was this bustling hub. You have to picture it. A constant stream of weary travelers, shrewd merchants, impassioned local politicians passing through.
All sorts of people.
All sorts. And this inn served as a veritable living classroom for young Martin. He wasn't just watching. He was serving drinks, listening intently to these heated debates about the fledgling republic.
Picking things up.
Picking things up, learning the subtle art of negotiation and persuasion firsthand. He saw how all these different groups, the old Dutch families, the new English settlers, disgruntled farmers, ambitious lawyers, how they interacted, how grievances were aired, and how consensus was sometimes, painstakingly built.
That informal education was probably worth more than any formal schooling at that point.
I think so. That education in human nature, community interactions, forged in his father's inn, would prove absolutely invaluable later on.
And this really raises that important question.
Hmm.
How did growing up in such a predominantly Dutch-speaking, culturally distinct environment shape his perspective, his whole approach to politics?
Yeah.
The sources are quite clear that the social interaction skills he learned there, dealing with people from varied ethnic, income, societal groups, were foundational. He wasn't just learning how to talk, he was learning how to read people.
Mm-hmm. How to mediate.
How to mediate disputes, how to build rapport across divides. These were skills he nurtured from childhood, honing his ability to navigate complex social situations, which later became the bedrock of his political genius.
That makes sense.
And what's also remarkable, a detail often overlooked, Martin Van Buren was the first U.S. president not born a British subject.
Ah, right, because of his birth date.
Exactly. He was born just a day after American and British diplomats agreed to the terms of the 1783 Treaty of Paris, which officially ended the Revolution.
Wow, talk about timing.
Right. This timing underscores his unique American identity. He was truly a product of the new nation, entirely of the Republic, not some former colonial subject carrying that baggage.
That must have given him a different perspective.
I think it did. A freedom from that colonial mindset that maybe shaped his unwavering focus on building a truly American political system, not just mimicking Britain.
Okay, so from this really practical childhood education at the inn, he moves into more formal, though still pretty basic, schooling. Village schoolhouse.
Standard for the time and place.
He did briefly study Latin at Kinderhook Academy and Washington Seminary, so there was some early intellectual curiosity there. But his formal education ended fairly early, 1796, when he began reading law as an apprentice.
The usual path for lawyers back then.
But what's really interesting here is his choice of mentors. He apprenticed first with Peter Sylvester and his son Francis. Now, they were staunch Federalists.
Which is interesting given his father's politics.
Exactly. Van Buren's father was a Democratic Republican. This early exposure to opposing political viewpoints, right within his legal training, it speaks volumes about a pragmatism developing early on.
He wasn't just absorbing one side.
No, it wasn't about blind loyalty. It was about learning from the best, regardless of party. And speaking of development, the sources tell us he initially wore rough, homespun clothing, you know, typical for a boy from Kinderhook. But his mentors advised him to pay more attention to his appearance, maybe sensing his ambition.
Smart advice.
He took it to heart, adopted this fastidious appearance, an amiable bearing that became his trademark. He was small, only 5'6".
Hence, Little Van.
Little Van, exactly. But his reddish sideburns and that undeniable political cunning also led to him being called the Red Fox of Kinderhook.
So many nicknames.
Right. Not just the little magician, which we'll get to, but also a red fox, and a very well-dressed one at that. It really highlights how image and perception were crucial, even then.
Oh, absolutely. Always have been.
And how Van Buren was acutely aware of it, skillfully crafting his public persona from early on.
That's such an astute observation about his early pragmatism and, yeah, image consciousness. What's truly fascinating is how deliberate his choices continued to be. He didn't just finish his apprenticeship with the Federalist Sylvesters. No.
No,
he then deliberately sought out William P. Van Ness. Now, Van Ness was a prominent political lieutenant of none other than Aaron Burr.
Aaron Burr. Wow.
That's a name. Right. This wasn't just about finishing legal training, it was a calculated move. He wanted to learn the intricate ropes of New York state politics directly from a master strategist. He meticulously observed Burr's legendary battles for control of the state party against powerful figures like George Clinton and Robert Livingston.
Learning the game from the inside.
Exactly. These experiences undoubtedly shaped his understanding of political factionalism, how to build coalitions, and crucially, how to maintain political power in a fiercely contested landscape like New York. This period really cemented his Democratic-Republican leanings and his burgeoning understanding of how to build and operate a political machine.
It sounds like he was always thinking several moves ahead.
Always. Now, on a more personal note, it's worth pausing here for a moment. In 1807, he married Hannah Hose.
His childhood sweetheart.
Yes, and his first cousin once removed, actually. She came from that same tight-knit Dutch community, also spoke Dutch as her first language. Their bond was clearly strong, but tragedy struck early. Hannah contracted tuberculosis.
Oh, no.
And passed away relatively young in 1819, leaving Van Buren a widower with four young sons.
Four sons, wow. Did he remarry?
He never remarried after her death. Think about that for a moment. In an era when remarriage was common, especially for a man with young children,
right.
Van Buren remained dedicated to her memory. Now, by all accounts, he was a devoted father, but this loss seems to have channeled an already immense energy even more singularly into his public life.
You wonder how that shaped him.
One might speculate that this profound personal experience, the solitude, the weight of raising his children alone, perhaps it hardened his resolve or allowed him to detach emotionally in ways that made him an even more formidable political operator.
It certainly offers a glimpse into the man beneath the little magician persona, the personal cost behind the political ambition.
Definitely.
That's a really poignant detail, and it does make you wonder if that personal loss contributed to the sort of emotional detachment or pragmatism he became known for.
It's possible. A heavy price, if so.
Upon his return to Kinderhook in 1803, Van Buren quickly formed a law partnership. And by 1807, he was financially secure enough to dive even deeper into politics. He'd already been active since he was, what, 18?
Yeah, very young. Already showing that knack for organization.
Securing nominations for allies, that kind of thing. His early career saw him making strategic alliances a real hallmark of his style. First, he aligned with powerful figures like DeWitt Clinton and Daniel D. Tompkins, key players in New York.
Big names.
But then came a pivotal and characteristically shrewd break with Clinton over the War of 1812.
Ah, yes. That was a big split.
Huge. Van Buren sided firmly with the Madison administration, a decision that would prove incredibly prescient and bolster his national standing later on. He served as surrogate of Columbia County, a legal administrative post, before moving his family to Hudson to further his career.
Moving up.
In 1812, he won election to the New York State Senate, strongly supported Madison during the war. He even served as a special judge advocate, prosecuting the controversial General William Hull during his court-martial.
Hull's surrender to Detroit was a huge scandal.
Exactly. And he collaborated with General Winfield Scott on reorganizing the New York militia, was so impressed by Scott, he named one of his sons after him.
Winfield Scott Van Buren.
That's the one. And here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Van Buren wasn't just a politician. He was a master strategist.
The organizer.
He understood the mechanics of power, knew how to build it from the ground up, and wasn't afraid to shift alliances if it served his broader vision for the party and the state. His unwavering support for the war significantly boosted his standing, leading directly to his election as New York Attorney General in 1815.
He was definitely building something new.
Absolutely.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Van Buren's true genius wasn't just winning elections himself, but creating the machinery to win them consistently for his chosen candidates, for the party.
Right. The system.
His strategic foresight was evident early on. For example, he was a vocal supporter of the Erie Canal construction, which was massive.
Clinton's ditch, they called it.
Right. And he supported it despite opposition from some of his traditional allies. He saw the long-term benefit for the state's economy and political influence. But it was his leadership of an anti-Clintonian faction in New York known as the Bucktails. That truly revolutionized American politics. This led directly to the establishment of the Albany Regency.
Okay, the Albany Regency. Explain that. What was it?
It was this formidable political machine, really unlike anything seen before in America. It was meticulously structured. It emphasized unwavering party loyalty, not just to individuals, but to the party platform.
Loyalty above all.
Absolutely. It systematically utilized patronage, the distribution of government jobs, contracts to reward supporters, and solidify commitment. Think key administrative positions, judgeships, even those canal contracts we mentioned, all leveraged to build a loyal network.
Smart. And ruthless, maybe.
Pragmatic, certainly. The Regency also heavily relied on loyal newspapers like the Albany Argus to shape public opinion, disseminate the party line. It basically became the state's dominant political voice.
Controlling the narrative.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it built strong connections with local officials, ensuring the party's reach extended into every county, every town. Its support base was this powerful coalition of small farmers and the burgeoning Tammany Hall machine in New York City.
Tammany Hall.
And Van Buren largely determined Tammany Hall's political policy for the state's Democratic Republicans. This wasn't just about local power in New York. It was about pioneering a new, deeply influential model of party organization for America.
A blueprint.
He famously understood that strong party attachment could, quote, furnish a complete antidote for sectional prejudices. That's a profound insight for a young nation grappling with these emerging regional divisions that were threatening to tear it apart.
So party loyalty is a unifying force.
Exactly. Loyalty to a national party with national goals could transcend local squabbles, or so he believed. He also guided a New York State referendum in 1821 that expanded voting rights to basically all white men.
Which helped Tammany Hall, presumably.
Naturally brought more voters into the fold. However, it's worth noting, while he favored expanded rights, he also tried to maintain some property requirements for voting. So it shows a nuanced, maybe pragmatic approach to suffrage, not just outright universalism.
Always weighing the options.
Always weighing the ideal against the practical, even on something as fundamental as voting rights.
That distinction is crucial. A reformer but a pragmatic one. His ascent continued rapidly, and in February 1821, the New York State Legislature elected Van Buren to the U.S. Senate.
Off to Washington.
So he arrived in Washington during the so-called era of good feelings. It's a period often romanticized as a time of national unity, right? Lack of partisan divisions after the Federalists faded.
A bit of a misnomer, perhaps.
Well, Van Buren, ever the architect, saw this not as peace, but as a vacuum, an opportunity to re-engineer the system. He quickly became a prominent figure in D.C., known not for being some thunderous orator.
Not a Clay or a Webster in that sense.
No, but known for his extensive research, meticulous attention to detail, and his frequent, though maybe not exceptional, speaking on the Senate floor. He was deeply engaged, serving on the powerful Senate Finance Committee and as chairman of the critical Senate Judiciary Committee.
Important posts.
Very. And it was during this time that his political acumen, his cunning, truly show on the national stage, solidifying those monikers, the Little Magician and the Sly Fox.
They stuck.
He wasn't just there to serve his term. He was there to rebuild, to create a new, more effective, and in his view, more stable national party system, laying the groundwork for what we now recognize as the second party system in America.
You know, that's a really counterintuitive take for many people today, the idea that friction, that partisan divide, could actually be seen as constructive.
Right, we usually think of gridlock.
Exactly. So what was it about that lack of clear division, the era of good feelings, that he found so problematic, or maybe just inefficient?
Good question. Why did he value a strong two-party system so highly?
He believed that without clear, philosophically distinct parties, elections would just devolve into purely personal contests, or worse, regional squabbles, rather than actual debates about national issues. He'd seen the Federalist-Democratic-Republican divide, and for all its contention, he viewed it as ultimately beneficial, a framework for meaningful policy discussion.
So structure helps focus the debate.
That was his thinking. He thought it actually strengthened national unity by forcing these larger conversations, binding different states together under a common party banner. So in the chaotic 1824 presidential election, you had four major candidates, right? He initially backed William H. Crawford of Georgia.
Yeah, for it.
He saw Crawford as embodying those true Jeffersonian principles, states' rights, limited government. He thought Crawford could unite a coalition of New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, that traditional Democratic-Republican alignment.
But that election was a mess.
A total mess. The fallout, no clear winner, the House decides, and then the infamous corrupt bargain allegations against John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay. It was a political firestorm.
How did Van Buren handle that?
With extraordinary shrewdness. Despite his deep personal opposition to Adams's more Hamiltonian economic policies, you know, federal infrastructure, a national bank, he remained remarkably neutral in the public controversy. He even voted to confirm Clay's nomination as Secretary of State.
Playing the long game.
Absolutely playing the long game. He was positioning himself. His crucial decision was to pivot and align decisively with Andrew Jackson for the 1828 election.
Ah, the Jackson connection.
This was key. He brought Crawford's backers and other anti-Adams factions into this formidable coalition. He forged alliances with figures who would become central to the new Democratic Party, John C. Calhoun.
Initially,
yes. Thomas Hart Benton, John Randolph. He saw Jackson, the war hero, the man of the people, as the unifying figure who could restore those philosophical party divisions he thought were so essential. This wasn't blind loyalty to Old Hickory. It was a calculated long-term move to shape the future of American politics around principled national party lines.
That's a truly sophisticated understanding of political power, looking way beyond the immediate win. And the tariff of 1828, which came to be dubbed the Tariff of Abominations.
Oh, yes. Deeply unpopular in the South.
A classic example of Van Buren's strategic thinking in practice. This tariff was meticulously designed to protect northern and western agricultural products, raising duties on imported raw materials like wool and iron.
Helping those regions.
But here's the twist. The strategic genius, maybe. Well, it helped some. It simultaneously angered New England importers, who saw their costs rise, and crucially, Southern cotton interest.
Because they imported manufactured goods and exported cotton.
Exactly. High tariffs meant potential retaliation from Europe and higher prices for goods they needed. So what does this mean for Van Buren? He was willing to alienate both New England and the Deep South because he believed, quite correctly, that those regions were unlikely to support Jackson anyway.
Calculated risk.
His strategic calculus was about securing support where it mattered most, for Jackson's presidential bid in the growing northern and western states, while sowing discontent among the anti-Jacksonians. Amidst all this, Van Buren also successfully ran for governor of New York in 1828.
A very short term, though.
Very short. A tactical masterstroke, really. A temporary but crucial move to ensure New York's electoral votes went to Jackson. He served just 43 days before resigning to join Jackson's cabinet.
But he still got something done, didn't he?
He did. Despite its brevity, his achievement as governor was significant. He championed and signed the Bank Safety Fund Law. This was an early, really innovative form of deposit insurance designed to protect banknotes and deposits from bank failures.
Ahead of its time.
Totally. A pragmatic financial reform, foreshadowing later federal banking regulations. It showed his dedication to stability and public trust, even in a blink-and-you-miss-it term.
His critical role truly blossomed in the Jackson administration. He became Secretary of State from 1829 to 1831 and proved himself a highly effective diplomat, actually.
What were some of his successes there?
Well, on the foreign policy front, he achieved several things that often go unnoticed. He settled long-standing claims against France, winning reparations for property seized during the Napoleonic Wars that was important for American merchants.
Right.
He reached a crucial agreement with the British to finally open trade with the British West Indies, which had been closed off, boosting American commerce significantly. And he concluded a treaty with the Ottoman Empire that gained American merchants access to the lucrative Black Sea trade routes.
So real tangible results.
Real results. Though some complex issues remained unresolved. That persistent Maine-New Brunswick boundary dispute, the Oregon country claim, negotiating a commercial treaty with Russia, and his unsuccessful attempts to persuade Mexico to sell Texas.
Texas was already
looming large. Beyond foreign affairs, Van Buren was absolutely indispensable as a key advisor to Jackson on domestic issues. He was instrumental in convincing Jackson to issue the Maysville Road veto in 1830.
Why was that significant?
It wasn't just about rejecting funding for a road in Kentucky. It was a powerful statement reinforcing limited government principles, strict construction of the Constitution, arguing federal funds shouldn't be for purely local projects. And, crucially for Van Buren, it strategically protected New York's Erie Canal interests from potential federal competition.
Always thinking of New York.
Always. But perhaps most famously, this period was defined by the infamous Petticoat Affair.
Ah, the Washington Wives drama.
It was far more than just gossip. It was a power struggle that reshaped Jackson's cabinet and, in many ways, paved Van Buren's path to the presidency. The ostracism of Peggy Eaton, wife of the Secretary of War John Eaton, by other cabinet wives, led primarily by Floride Calhoun, wife of VP John C. Calhoun, created this deep personal rift.
They wouldn't socialize with her.
Refused to. Fueled by rumor, social snobbery, they believed her character was questionable. Now, as a widower, Van Buren was uniquely positioned. He was unaffected by this social boycott.
He didn't have a wife in the fight.
Exactly. He could remain neutral, even extended courtesies to Peggy Eaton, which dramatically earned him Jackson's deep gratitude and trust. His masterstroke came when he offered his own resignation.
Really? Why?
Prompting a full cabinet reorganization. This effectively removed Calhoun's allies and further cemented Van Buren's place as Jackson's most trusted advisor and likely successor. It made Van Buren look loyal, indispensable, while strategically isolating Calhoun, much to Calhoun's chagrin.
Wow. The little magician indeed, turning social scandal into political advantage.
Precisely.
And Calhoun really showed his chagrin later, didn't he? Jackson, eager to reward Van Buren, gave him a recess appointment as ambassador to Britain in 1831.
Sent him off to London.
Van Buren was cordially received, making a good impression. But then in February 1832, while he's abroad, he learns of Calhoun's political revenge.
The Senate rejection.
Calhoun had successfully orchestrated a Senate rejection, casting the deciding vote himself. Reportedly exclaiming with glee that it would kill him dead, sir, kill him dead. He will never kick, sir, never kick.
Famous last words, politically speaking.
Absolutely, because here's the aha moment. Calhoun's move spectacularly backfired. Instead of ending Van Buren's career, it dramatically cast him as a victim of petty partisan politics, a martyr of loyalty.
Made him look sympathetic.
Immensely boosted his standing with Jackson and the Democratic Party base. Jackson was outraged. Saw it as an attack on his loyal friend, and pushed for his nomination as vice president.
So Calhoun basically handed him the VP slot.
Pretty much. Propelled him directly onto Jackson's winning ticket for the 1832 election. Clear heir apparent. It was a monumental miscalculation by Calhoun, a classic case of political overreach.
Indeed, Calhoun's maneuver was a boomerang, just came right back at him and solidified Van Buren's position. By the end of his vice presidency, 1833 to 1837, the American political landscape was truly transformed, largely thanks to Van Buren's strategic foresight.
So what did he do as VP?
He continued as one of Jackson's primary advisors, supported him fiercely in the tumultuous bank war. Van Buren viewed the Second Bank of the U.S. as an extension of those Hamiltonian principles. He hated a powerful, centralized institution favoring elite financial interests, contributing to economic instability.
He was a hard money guy, right?
Big time. Championed gold and silver over easily inflated paper currency. He also counseled conciliation during the nullification crisis.
When South Carolina threatened to secede over tariffs.
Exactly. Van Buren advocated for a diplomatic solution to avoid a confrontation that could shatter the Union. And crucially, during this period, he deftly helped undermine any potential alliances between Jackson and other powerful figures like Daniel Webster, alliances that could have threatened his long-term project, creating two strong parties separated by clear policy differences.
Not just personalities.
Not just personalities or regions. By the end of this era, Jackson's supporters were firmly the Democratic Party. His opponents, Clay's National Republicans, Calhoun's followers, Webster's allies, many anti-Masons had coalesced into the Whig Party.
The second party system is born.
Van Buren's vision for a philosophically divided yet nationally binding two-party system was fully realized. It became the dominant structure for American politics for decades. He literally built the framework.
Okay, so with Andrew Jackson's powerful endorsement, that huge legacy, and the formidable organizational strength of the new Democratic Party,
he was set up pretty well.
Van Buren easily won the 1836 election against a divided Whig opposition. He was the chosen successor, tasked with continuing Jackson's policies, upholding the legacy. But sometimes inheriting a legacy means inheriting its problems, too.
Oh, definitely. And Jackson left some big ones simmering.
Van Buren was about to learn this the hard way. Sworn in March 4th, 1837, to ensure continuity and try to restore confidence in the Democrats as a party of sectional unity, he largely retained Jackson's cabinet and lower-level appointees.
Smart move for stability, initially.
His cabinet was strategically chosen, representing different regions, New England, South, West, reflecting his belief in National Party cohesion. His approach to cabinet meetings was notably formal, quite different from Jackson's informal kitchen cabinet.
More structured.
Yeah, he actively solicited advice, tolerated open, even frank exchanges. He saw himself as, quote, a mediator and to some extent an umpire between the conflicting opinions of his counselors. Allowed him to reserve judgment, protect his final decision-making power.
Methodical, organized leader.
Exactly. Even if the immense challenges he was about to face would test that carefully cultivated style to its absolute limit.
And they came fast. When Van Buren took office, the nation's economy had already taken a severe turn. That heady prosperity of the early 1830s, over. Fueled by land speculation, easy credit. It was a bubble waiting to burst.
A good burst it did.
Just 2 months into his presidency, May 10th, 1837, the Panic of 1837 erupted. Important state banks in New York, running out of hard currency specie, gold and silver, refused to convert paper money. Cascade effect.
Bang.
Essentially. Financial institutions nationwide quickly followed suit, suspending specie payments. This triggered a devastating five-year depression. Businesses failed by the thousands, land values plummeted, unemployment hit record highs in cities.
5 years? That's brutal.
Brutal. This isn't just a historical event. It's a profound testament to the fragile nature of economic systems and the immense pressure on a new president. Van Buren, champion of hard money and limited government, largely blamed greedy American and foreign business and financial institutions and the reckless overextension of credit by U.S. banks, especially those smaller pet banks that proliferated after Jackson killed the National Bank.
But the Whigs blamed Jackson and Van Buren.
Whoa, immediately. Pointed fingers squarely at Democratic policies, removing federal deposits from the Second Bank of the U.S., and Jackson's controversial 1836 specie circular, which required payment for federal land in gold or silver.
How did that contribute?
They argued the specie circular drained specie from eastern banks, forcing them to call in loans, triggering the initial crisis. The panic loomed large over the 1838 elections, led to significant Whig gains. Then a second commercial crisis later that year deepened public discontent.
So what was Van Buren's solution? He couldn't just blame others?
His proposed solution was the independent treasury system, or sub-treasury. This was a truly radical departure at the time.
How so?
Until then, federal funds were typically held in various state banks. Van Buren believed this practice contributed to speculative lending and instability. He wanted a complete separation. The federal government would handle its own money entirely, storing federal funds in its own vaults, in specie gold and silver, not relying on private banks.
Taking the government out of the banking business, essentially.
Exactly. It wasn't just about security. It was about preventing another boom and bust cycle by restricting the printing of easily inflated paper money. He believed a hard money policy would stabilize the economy long term.
Did people go for it?
Fierce opposition. Conservative Democrats feared it gave the government too much power. Whigs, like Henry Clay, argued for a new national bank, believing it essential for credit and commerce. The debate wasn't just economic, it was deeply ideological.
Government's role in the economy. Still arguing about that today.
We are. It touched on fundamental questions. Should private enterprise or public institutions control the nation's financial pulse? It was a prolonged, bitter fight. Delayed implementation until 1840. By then, much political damage was done. The public was exhausted, angry about the lingering depression.
So it sounds like he was really trying to build this firebreak between government and private banking, aiming for stability, but just ran headfirst into those fundamental American tensions. Did he ever see it truly work?
It was repealed by the Whigs shortly after he left office, then reenacted under Polk, and lasted until the Federal Reserve System was created much later. So its legacy is complex, but the idea itself was significant.
Okay. While grappling with this huge economic crisis, Van Buren also inherited the Indian removal policy from Jackson.
Another toxic inheritance.
And this leads us to one of the most tragic and, frankly, morally fraught chapters of his presidency, the Trail of Tears.
A stain on American history.
The Indian Removal Act of 1830, under Jackson, aimed to move tribes west of the Mississippi, often under duress. During Van Buren's presidency, the government negotiated 19 treaties with various tribes, pushing them westward. A pivotal and deeply controversial one was the 1835 Treaty of New Echota.
Signed by only a small faction of the Cherokee.
Exactly. Not recognized by the majority. It established terms for their voluntary relocation. When, predictably, many Cherokees refused to comply, Van Buren, in 1838, directed General Winfield Scott to forcibly move all who hadn't yet vacated their ancestral lands.
Forcibly is putting it mildly.
Brutally rounded up, often at bayonet point, herded into unsanitary internment camps during a sweltering summer. Their forced march westward was delayed by intense heat and drought, leading to unimaginable suffering.
The numbers are staggering.
An estimated 4,000 Cherokee, nearly a quarter of your population, died during this forced removal, forever known as the Trail of Tears. Some entire nations lost maybe half their populations during these removals overall.
Even prominent figures protested. Emerson wrote him a letter, didn't he?
Yes. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote Van Buren a scathing letter of protest, condemning the moral outrage. Van Buren, for his part, tried to justify the policy by invoking the prevailing sentiment, claiming, quote, "Mixed occupancy of the same territory by the white and red man is incompatible with the safety or happiness of either."
A common but deeply flawed justification of the time.
He also falsely asserted the Cherokees hadn't protested their removal, despite clear evidence otherwise. He also continued the costly Second Seminole War in Florida, an intractable conflict draining federal resources.
That war dragged on forever.
Though his administration eventually negotiated a compromise, allowing remaining Seminoles to stay in Southwest Florida, recognizing full removal was nearly impossible. The human cost was immense. These are incredibly difficult decisions made in a morally ambiguous era with profound, lasting consequences that still echo today.
A stark reminder of the complexities and ethical dilemmas of leadership in that period.
Definitely.
And beyond the domestic turmoil of the economy and Indian removal, Van Buren faced significant international pressures, which actually he navigated with a surprising skill and a firm commitment to peace, often overlooked.
Like what?
Let's look at Texas first. Just before leaving office, Jackson had recognized the Republic of Texas and suggested quick annexation.
Provocative.
Very. Immediately raised fears of war with Mexico, which still claimed Texas, and crucially heightened sectional tensions over slavery. New England abolitionists charged a slaveholding conspiracy, fearing more slave states.
So what does Van Buren do?
He made a bold reversal of Jackson's policy, rejected Texas annexation in 1837. His stated reasons were constitutional scruples and fear of war with Mexico, but primarily it was a deeper concern over the explosive issue of slavery's extension. It could shatter the delicate balance in Congress.
Protecting the Union or the party.
Probably both. There was this unspoken rule between Northern and Southern Democrats. Northerners would help quash anti-slavery proposals, Southerners would refrain from agitating for Texas annexation, maintained a fragile unity. Van Buren refused to upset that balance. Texas eventually withdrew its annexation offer in 1838.
So he prevented a war and a major slavery crisis, for a time.
For a time, yes. His commitment to peace there was quite calculated. Then there were the Canadian rebellions of 1837, 1838. American volunteers, sympathetic to the rebels, aided them across the border, led to the infamous Caroline episode.
Where the British burned a U.S. ship.
British forces crossed into U.S. territory, burned and sank the steamboat Caroline on the American side of the Niagara River, killed one American. Public sentiment on both sides screamed for war.
But Van Buren
acted swiftly and decisively, sent General Scott to the border to maintain neutrality, prevent war, proactively passed a neutrality law to stop Americans aiding foreign rebellions.
Kept a lid on it.
Kept a lid on it. Later, the Aroostook War flared up. 1838, 1839, entirely bloodless but tense, border dispute between Maine and New Brunswick over timber rights.
Loggers fighting.
Tensions escalated, arrests, militia mobilizations. The American press screamed sensational headlines, Maine and her soil, or blood.
Sounds familiar.
Again, Van Buren intervened diplomatically, sent Scott to de-escalate, eventually led to arbitration and the definitive 1842 Webster-Ashburton Treaty. His consistent commitment to peace and stability in North America, even facing public clamor for war, is often underrated. He navigated these crises with remarkable skill, avoiding conflicts that could have dramatically altered the young nation's trajectory.
That's incredible. Navigating those volatile border disputes without firing a shot, while simultaneously trying to calm a raging economic storm at home. Wow. Okay, here's another moment that might surprise you, bringing together freedom, law, politics at the highest level. The Amistad case.
Ah, yes. The Spielberg movie brought that back to public attention.
Right. The 1839 rebellion of enslaved Africans on the Spanish schooner La Amistad. The Africans, led by Sangbipia, or Joseph Sinque, seized control after being illegally abducted from Sierra Leone. The ship ended up in American waters off Long Island, seized by the U.S. Navy.
And the Van Buren administration's position.
They supported Spain's demand to return the ship and the Africans as property. This was consistent with his long-held stance against federal interference with slavery where it existed, and crucially driven by concerns about relations with Spain and viewing abolitionism as a dangerous threat to national unity, especially Southern stability.
But abolitionists got involved.
A tenacious group of abolitionist lawyers intervened, arguing the Africans weren't enslaved persons but illegally captured individuals. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Where John Quincy Adams argued for them.
Former President John Quincy Adams, now a congressman, argued passionately and eloquently for the Africans' freedom, directly challenging the Van Buren administration. In 1841, just after Van Buren left office, the Supreme Court ruled the Amistad Africans were indeed free, having been illegally enslaved.
Huge victory for the abolitionist cause.
Huge. It heightened public interest in slavery, attracted new support for abolitionism, and made the courts this crucial, often volatile, forum for debating slavery's legal and moral foundations.
A landmark case.
Meanwhile, back at the White House, as a widower, Van Buren initially handled hostess duties himself, a considerable burden. But when his eldest son Abraham married the elegant Angelica Singleton in 1838, she took on the role.
And she brought a certain style.
Oh, yes. Influenced by her distant relative, the esteemed Dolly Madison, Angelica embraced a style of European court life and receptions, opulent decor, formal etiquette. This, coupled with rumors she wanted to landscape the White House grounds like European royal gardens, became a potent political target.
Oh.
A Pennsylvania Whig congressman, Charles Ogle, delivered the famous Gold Spoon Oration in Congress. Sensational, highly exaggerated speech depicting Van Buren as this effeminate aristocrat living lavishly, gold spoons, French furniture, luxuries supposedly at taxpayer expense.
The original latte liberal attack.
Kind of. This speech, widely circulated, effectively weaponized personal details, social optics, contributed significantly to the narrative that Van Buren was out of touch, aristocratic, played a major role in his re-election defeat. It's incredible how personal details, like White House reception style, could be so devastatingly weaponized.
It truly speaks to the raw power of a narrative, even over policy in American politics, something Van Buren himself usually understood so well, but this time it was used against him. His presidency was indeed dominated by that severe economic downturn, other divisive issues, making his re-election campaign an uphill battle.
Martin Van Ruin, they called him.
Exactly. The Whigs, sensing public discontent over Martin Van Ruin and the lingering depression, opted for a highly strategic and ultimately successful shift in the 1840 election. Instead of nominating a strong policy voice like Clay,
they went with Harrison.
William Henry Harrison, war hero, little political baggage, positioned him as a man of the people against an effete corrupt Van Buren. The Whig campaign was a masterclass in image over policy, almost entirely populist appeal.
The Log Cabin and Hard Cider campaign
famously depicted Harrison, inaccurately, as this humble frontiersman living in a log cabin, sipping hard cider, while ridiculing Van Buren as an aristocrat living in high style, out of touch. They used slogans like, Van is a used-up man, and Martin Van Ruin tapping into deep public anger and economic hardship.
Did it work?
This strategy, plus the profound public discontent, made it impossible for Van Buren to win a second term. Despite actually winning more popular votes than he had in 1836, quite an achievement given the climate he lost to Harrison in a landslide. 234 electoral votes to his 60.
Wow.
And an astonishing 80% of eligible voters went to the polls. Intense public engagement, widespread desire for change. This election was a powerful testament to the influence of image and narrative. Marked a clear shift where emotional appeal, character assassination could, and often did, trump substantive policy debates.
After that crushing defeat in 1840, Van Buren returned to his magnificent estate, Lindenwald, in Kinderhook. After such a tough defeat, many politicians might just retreat entirely, right? Write their memoirs?
You'd think so, especially after being painted so negatively.
But Van Buren, the ultimate political animal, was far from done. He continued to closely observe political developments, including the tumultuous Tyler presidency after Harrison died just a month into his term.
Tippecanoe and Tyler II, and then just Tyler.
Right. And Van Buren would reemerge, quite surprisingly, on a different and a very principled side of a burgeoning national debate. It shows a profound evolution in his political and moral convictions that would really reshape his legacy.
This really raises that important question again. Why did Van Buren, the consummate politician, the master strategist, risk his political future by opposing Texas annexation? He had to know it would likely cost him the Democratic nomination in 1844.
What do the sources say?
They clearly state he believed immediate annexation would lead to an unjust war with Mexico, and far more critically, would extend slavery into vast new territories. Further destabilizing the Union, he'd worked so hard to build party structures around.
So principle over party this time.
It seems so. His old rival, John C. Calhoun, played a significant, calculated role here. Calhoun advocated immediate annexation, not just for land, but explicitly to upend the presidential race and expand slavery's reach.
Using Texas as a wedge issue.
Exactly. At the 1844 Democratic National Convention, despite Van Buren having secured a first ballot majority, the two-thirds rule was controversially reimposed.
The rule requiring two-thirds of delegates.
Yes. It was specifically designed to prevent Van Buren's nomination, as he couldn't reach that threshold without Southern support, which he'd alienated by opposing annexation. It was a clear demonstration of the South's growing power within the party and its determination to protect slavery.
So they blocked him. Mm. Who got the nomination?
Though angered by this blatant manipulation, Van Buren, ever the party loyalist in some ways, ultimately endorsed the dark horse candidate James K. Polk for party unity. But his stance here, though politically costly, reveals this growing moral opposition to slavery that would define his later years. A willingness to prioritize principle over immediate political gain quite different from some earlier calculations.
That principled stance at such a high political cost truly is a remarkable pivot, especially for a politician who, just a few years earlier as VP, cast the tie-breaking Senate vote for a bill to prohibit abolitionist mail in the South.
It shows a real evolution, a profound shift.
In his post-presidency, Van Buren grew increasingly vocal opposing slavery's expansion. He aligned himself with the Barn Burner faction of the New York Democratic Party.
The Barn Burner's great name.
Right, a reformist, anti-slavery wing. Their opponents claim they were radical enough to burn down their own barn to get rid of the rats, meaning destroy the party, to get rid of pro-slavery elements.
Nice.
Van Buren published an influential anti-slavery manifesto, the Barn Burner Manifesto. It directly refuted the notion that Congress lacked power to regulate slavery in the territories. He argued compellingly that the Founding Fathers had actually favored eventual abolition, citing their original intentions and early legislative actions.
Using the Founders against the pro-slavery argument?
Exactly. This wasn't just a political calculation. It shows a profound evolution in his thinking on the nation's most divisive issue. moving from pragmatic acceptance of slavery where it existed to principled opposition to its expansion, putting his conscience ahead of his party's dominant Southern wing.
And his decision to run as the Free Soil Party candidate in 1848, that wasn't just about seeking office again, was it?
What was the motivation?
It was a powerful symbolic statement to demonstrate the burgeoning strength of the anti-slavery movement and strategically weaken his Democratic opponents, particularly Lewis Cass, who favored popular sovereignty.
Letting territories decide on slavery themselves.
Right. Van Buren ran on a platform fully supporting the Wilmot Proviso, banning slavery in all territories acquired from Mexico in the war. A direct challenge to the expansionist, pro-slavery Democrats. His running mate was none other than Charles Francis Adams.
Son of John Quincy, grandson of John Adams, that's dynasty joining forces.
Added significant intellectual and historical weight, bridging old political rivalries. Even Daniel Webster, the Whig orator, was skeptical about Van Buren's sincerity, famously joking about him, the former Free Spoil Party leader, suddenly becoming the leader of the Free Soil Party.
Did his candidacy have much impact?
Significant impact, actually. He won no electoral votes nationwide, but finished second to Whig Zachary Taylor in his home state, New York. Took enough crucial votes from Democrat Lewis Cass there to effectively help Taylor win the presidency.
The spoiler effect.
Exactly. Nationally, Van Buren won 10.1% of the popular vote. At that point, the strongest showing by a third-party presidential nominee ever. Even though he lost, his candidacy was a significant spoiler, fundamentally highlighting the growing sectional divide over slavery and shaping the outcome of a critical national election. Showed that even out of power, his political acumen could still shift national outcomes.
That 1848 run really underscores his complex, evolving political identity. So in his final years, what did he do? Did he stay involved?
He continued to engage deeply with the nation's unfolding crises. Profoundly troubled by secessionist stirrings in the South. Despite his growing moral opposition to slavery, he supported the Compromise of 1850.
Which included the Fugitive Slave Act.
Yes, which he personally opposed, but he saw the compromise as a necessary conciliatory measure to preserve the Union. He eventually returned to the Democratic Party, supporting Pierce, Buchanan, and Douglas in later elections, partly fearing a continued Democratic split would empower the Whigs and further destabilize things.
Still thinking about party stability.
He viewed the nascent know-nothing movement, anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, with utter contempt. Believed the anti-slavery Republican Party, though, was inadvertently exacerbating tensions, pushing the nation closer to civil war.
What about Dred Scott?
He considered Chief Justice Taney's infamous 1857 Dred Scott ruling that African Americans couldn't be citizens, Congress couldn't prohibit slavery in territories a grievous mistake, especially since it overturned the Missouri Compromise. Also harshly criticized President Buchanan's handling of Bleeding Kansas.
So increasingly critical of his own party's direction on slavery.
Yes. Finally, when the Civil War began, Van Buren, the ultimate unionist despite everything, publicly supported the Union cause and President Abraham Lincoln, believed preserving the Union was paramount.
He died during the war.
Yes. Died peacefully in Kinderhook in 1862 at age 79 after being bedridden with pneumonia. He saw an incredible sweep of American history, didn't he? From the Revolution's end to the darkest days of the Civil War. Outlived four of his successors, Harrison, Tyler, Polk, Taylor, witnessed eight presidents take office after him. A truly singular life. #36. The enduring legacy in pop culture echoes. So, if we connect all this to the bigger picture, Martin Van Buren's most lasting, arguably most significant achievement was undeniably his role as a political organizer and architect.
The party builder.
The party builder. He didn't just participate. He built the machinery of modern American politics, guiding the Democrats to dominance in the second party system. Historians like Robert Remini credit him with making the party system a, quote, sensible and intelligent way the affairs of the nation could be democratically conducted, a view that eventually won national approval.
Changing the perception of parties.
Fundamentally. Before him, parties were often viewed with suspicion necessary evils, temporary factions. Van Buren showed that well-organized, ideologically coherent parties could be essential for national governance, aggregating public opinion, fostering national unity across sections.
But his presidency itself, how's that rated?
Often ranked average at best. Largely due to that overwhelming economic crisis, the Panic of 1837, for which he was widely blamed as Martin Van Ruin. Historians are split on his independent treasury response. Too little, too late. or a sound, principled approach.
But there are other views.
Oh, yes. Some revisionist historians, particularly those with a more libertarian perspective like Ivan Eland, Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, offer contrasting, often highly complimentary views. They praise his handling of the panic for reducing government spending, balancing the budget, his unwavering commitment to hard money. They also commend him for successfully avoiding those potential wars with Canada and Mexico.
So skillful diplomacy gets points.
Hummel, in particular, boldly states Van Buren was America's greatest president, arguing historians have grossly underrated his many remarkable accomplishments in the face of heavy odds.
Greatest. Wow. That's a take.
It is. And this is where critical thinking comes in for us, right? How do we reconcile the forgettable label from Time magazine with the greatest American president claim? It's a powerful reminder that historical assessments are complex, multifaceted, often shift over time. Demands we look beyond conventional narratives, consider all the contradictory facets.
That's a perfect challenge for our listeners reevaluating what they think they know. So maybe not so forgettable after all, especially when you look at how he's unexpectedly popped up in modern culture.
Right. It's surprising.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Many of you listening have probably used a term today that directly relates to him.
Ah, the big word.
The origin of OK. Yes, that universal OK. Popularized as a slogan for old Kinderhook, referencing his birthplace, during his 1840 re-election campaign.
Oh.
His supporters formed OK Clubs. The term, initially a humorous abbreviated misspelling of all corrected, just stuck. Gained global recognition. So every time you say OK, you're echoing Van Buren's presidential campaign.
Amazing how language works.
Beyond linguistics, he's appeared in fiction. Gore Vidal's acclaimed 1973 historical novel, Burr, features a major plot theme trying to prevent Van Buren's election by proving he's Aaron Burr's illegitimate son.
Fictional, but juicy.
The satirical Deansbury comic strip even humorously depicted Skull and Bones members stealing his skull as a gift for George H.W. Bush, first VP since Van Buren, to win the presidency directly.
Always the skull stealing.
He's been honored on a presidential dollar coin in 2008, commemorative silver medals in 2021. His face is literally in public hands. And for film buffs, famously portrayed by the late, great Nigel Hawthorne in Spielberg's Amistad.
Showing his administration's controversial stance.
Right. Perhaps most famously in recent pop culture, the 1997 Seinfeld episode, The Van Buren Boys. A fictional street gang that admires him as a man who knew how to play the game. Their gang sign. Eight fingers, of course, for the eighth president.
Yeah, it was Kramer trying to make this up.
Exactly. We even have his Whig nickname, the Mistletoe Politician, implying he only survived by attaching himself parasitically to Old Hickory Jackson, like mistletoe to an oak.
Ouch. Politics was rough then, too.
From the halls of power to pop culture, even the words we use, Van Buren really did leave a mark, even if it's sometimes in the most unexpected and enduring ways. Hashtag tag outro. So from speaking Dutch as his first language to building the first truly modern political machine, navigating a national economic crisis of unprecedented scale, and ultimately taking that principled stand on slavery's expansion. Martin Van Buren's story is a testament to the complex, often contradictory, and undeniably impactful nature of American leadership.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man deeply shaped by his time, but also one who profoundly shaped the future trajectory of the nation. So after this deep dive, what stands out most to you about the Little Magician and his surprising legacy?
And this really raises an important final question for us today, I think. Given his pivotal role in creating the two-party system that still largely defines American politics, his commitment at times to principled policy debate over personal loyalty, and his remarkable, if gradual, evolving stance on slavery, how might Van Buren's strategic foresight and political adaptability offer lessons for navigating our own incredibly complex and polarized political landscape? What could he teach us about the long game of national politics, about building consensus, maybe, and about the courage, perhaps, to shift one's convictions, even when faced with immense challenges and the specter of political ruin?
Something to think about.
Something for you to mull over as you continue your own deep dives into history and ponder the enduring threads that connect the past to our present.
That's all the time we have for this deep dive into Martin Van Buren. Thank you for joining us on this journey through the past. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.